My name is Charles Cullen. They call me the Philosopher Killer. They say I'm evil, but I say I make my victims face the consequences of their own ideas. What about you? Could you defend your beliefs if your life depended on it?
Cruel Logic, The Philosopher Killer, a brilliant theological thriller novel by Brian James Godawa. Get it now at Amazon.com in Kindle, paperback, and audiobook.
I think Dostoevsky's, you know, example in his story, Brothers Karamazov, where, you know, you have Ivan and Alyosha, you know, debating about God and morality and suffering. And it's probably one of the, I think Dostoevsky's on the level of any philosopher. You know what I mean? In fact, I have that whole element of the Brothers Karamazov in my novel, because I do believe the way Dostoevsky dealt with the problem of evil and the existence of God is on par, probably better than any other philosophical attempt, in my opinion.
This is your nautical lantern on the dangerous seas of darkness. Let's push off from the placid shore of the status quo and explore what's beyond the horizon. I am your host, BT, and this is Truth and Shadow, your podcast of the supernatural.
In today's episode, we are going to be interviewing Brian Godawa. We speak at length about his new book, Cruel Logic, which is a psychological thriller. I find that this form of fiction is just as compelling, if not more so, than horror fiction. It's going to be a little bit different. It's not action-packed. It doesn't go from action to action to action sequence. And that's at the root of this particular form of genre. It invites the reader in, serves as a conduit for exploring the depths of human behavior and emotion. These stories invite readers to immerse themselves in narratives that are often unsettling. And the primary drive of these stories is the intricate development of character and the detailed exploration of psychological tension. It leaves us, the reader, to question our own perception of reality. Central to many psychological thriller narratives is the portrayal of the psychopath, a figure characterized by a lack of empathy, has got manipulative tendencies, and is quick to violence. The depiction of psychopathy and even sociopathy in fiction often serves as a reflection of society's fascination with the darker aspects of human nature. Thereby delving into the mind of the psychopath, the author confronts the reader with uncomfortable truths about the fragility of morality and the potential for darkness that exists within us all. One aspect that is probably the most compelling, most useful in the psychological thriller fiction is its ability to provoke introspection, to challenge our preconceived notions of right and wrong. And as readers, we accompany the protagonist or the antagonist on a journey through moral ambiguity. We watch as they are forced to confront difficult questions about the nature of life, of morality, and the human condition. It's in this vast landscape of literature that many readers are intrigued by the psychological thriller. And it seems to stand as a beacon of introspection and intrigue. This exploration of the human psyche and the enigmatic figure of a psychopath, this genre challenges us to confront uncomfortable truths about the things that we may have accepted because of our cultural dictums, of our norms, of our lives. But as we venture further into the realm of the psychological thriller as a genre, may we remain vigilant in our exploration of the darker recesses of the human mind. May we always seek to reconcile the moral aspects of the world with the truth that lie within.
In the twisted corridors of the human psyche lies an intricate dance between the mundane and the mysterious. The psychology of murder is a tapestry woven with threads of darkness and a hint of the unexplained. To help shed light on the mind of a murderer or guest, an investigative author has joined us to speak of the psychology of a killer. He is a symphony of innovation, wisdom, and integrity. The lighthouse of reason, the heartbeat of precision, navigating us through the shadows of night. Ryan Gadawa, thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, you are too kind.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me on. I love that. I love the verbiage. I love the verbiage.
You're welcome. You know, I've read a couple of your Nephilim books, but that's not why I wanted to pull you on here. I wanted to talk to you about your more recent books dealing specifically with philosophy of murder. And I wanted to talk to you about the idea of somebody who is a murderer and their motivations. What got you started writing this thread instead of the Nephilim Chronicles?
Yeah, well, good question. Kind of has a history to it, but the novel you're referring to is called Cruel Logic, The Philosopher Killer, and I just released it in September. And it's been getting some really good responses. It's controversial, so it's also getting some hate responses as well, which is a good sign.
Yes.
Because it is the story of a brilliant serial killer who was actually a philosophy professor. And what he does is he captures university professors and he debates them. And the topic of his debate is his moral right to kill them. So he'll basically see, he'll pull aside a professor, tape them, tie them up in a chair type of thing and videotape it. And he'll say, okay, look, if what you say is true about reality, then give me one valid reason why I should not kill you and I will let you go. And, he'll have all these professors at a modern woke university, whether it's a evolutionary biologist or a queer theorist and on and on, and another philosophy professor, et cetera. And, of course he's going on this bizarre, twisted, immoral crusade, so to speak, for reasons not automatically revealed, and that are part of the twist as well. But on the surface, though, it's taking place in a woke university, and a concurrent. And so, while we have a cop and a psychiatrist tracking down the killer, they're doing it in the context of this woke university. So I have another storyline that I'm telling along with the story, which is a evangelical freshman who's a Christian, evangelical Christian, going to college for the first time, a secular university. It's a fictional one in California. And it's how he becomes drawn into and sucked up into the social justice movement on campus. And so, and all the kind of things that have been going on that we know about now in the news, of course, yes. All that stuff is going on in this university. And if you think it through, they're very connected, but people don't always see those connections. And I hope to be able to make that connection through this story as well. But that's the heart and soul of the story. But its origins come really from a long time ago. Actually, I've had I've always had a love for Christian apologetics and philosophy. And so I've learned a lot in my life pursuing answers to these questions and doubts and skepticism and such, and trying to understand the world and taking seriously, the attacks against my faith, how could a loving God allow all this evil, that kind of stuff. But, so I've always been interested in those issues, but as a storyteller, as a professional storyteller, I started out as a screenwriter in Hollywood, and You know, I'd come up with this idea many years ago, actually, for Crew Logic as a script. And I actually wrote it as a, you know, sort of a low budget horror, like a Saw, you know, kind of thing, years ago. And it won all these screenwriting awards and I tried to get it made as a movie for years and I just couldn't get it made. And I even got to one point where I took one of the scenes out of the movie and I shot an extended version of a scene, which is one of these debates that the professor has, right? And I shot it as a sort of a trailer to pitch the idea as well. And people can still find that on my website. If they go to Gadawa.com, you can track it down. It's a cool little 7-minute short, kind of gives you the vibe of it. But of course, there's also the trailer that you've shown on your podcast here. But
yeah.
So I came up with that idea, but I was inspired by an older Christian apologist from many years ago. His name was Walter Martin, and he was around in the 70s. So I was listening to his tapes, like, you know, decade later, you know, after he was already dead. And I was listening to him describing his frustration talking to an atheist on this old TV or radio show, and how this atheist couldn't understand. He was trying to explain to him, you believe in morality, but you don't have a foundation for morality within your atheism. And, you know, the guy kept saying, well, yes, I do. I believe murder's right or wrong, or, you know, murder's wrong, not right, sorry. I believe in morals and stuff. And he got so frustrated, he just said, okay, look, you know, he thought of this image, and he said, it's 1940s Germany. I'm a Nazi pointing a gun at you, and you're a Jew. Give me one valid reason why I shouldn't kill you, you know? And I never forgot that, obviously, because it ultimately became sort of the foundation of this script, because in my mind, though I love apologetics and philosophy, I know that most people don't. And it makes for very boring material, you know, for a lot of people. But I love that. But I also love entertainment. And I thought, and another thing is the whole intellectualization process. A lot of people aren't as tuned into that. They aren't as interested in intellectual debates and all that kind of stuff. But so I've always looked for ways that can embody in story the very philosophical ideas that I believe in or that I try to communicate. And this was a perfect example of that, because in a sense, it's the tangible incarnation of the moral argument for the existence of God. We could sit here and debate abstracts and philosophy, but if you place someone in that situation where they have to defend their life for their beliefs, that's when they can finally be faced with the reality of what their belief system leads to, because ideas have consequences. Mm-hmm. But the thing is story allows you to embody those consequences in a dramatic narrative that makes it more interesting. And that was my goal, was to make philosophy great again. No, my goal was to make philosophy interesting and you know, worthy of people's time within an entertaining context. And but also to do so, you know, from as a Christian as well. I just think that it's the most powerful expression of the moral argument is this story scenario. So that's sort of the origin of it. But I, you know, like I said, I wrote it as a movie years ago. And I became a novelist about 12 years ago. And my novels have been growing successfully since then. And in fact, I've been wanting to make Cruel Logic into a novel forever, but I've been so successful with this Nephilim series and other books like it that I haven't had the time to. And finally, I forced myself. I said, look, this is the time when, all, you know, in the last 5 years, we've seen this explosion of, well, the wokeness in universities. Let's put it this way. It's been there for a long time, but the explosion of the awareness of what's going on, and they're pushing the limits now. And I just thought, this is so relevant, because it's not just, you know, I'm not just dealing with a moral argument for the existence of God. I'm dealing with a culture embodied in higher education that rejects God first and foremost, and then seeks to build a philosophy of the world apart from that God. And this is and the woke world, which is basically the leftist paradigm, Marxist, postmodern, you know, social justice, all that stuff kind of wrapped up together and with its various manifestations, of course. But that is very relevant because if you look at what's going on in university, you see that there is a concerted, deliberate attack on Western civilization as a worldview. And yeah. they will even say this deliberately. You know, yeah, we hate Western civilization. And of course, Western civilization is rooted in amongst other things, mostly in Judeo-Christianity.
Right.
And so that's the ultimate villain to these people. But they, you know, they've been attacking this for decades. They've, you know, they've done all kinds of things in higher education to get rid of Western civilization. And I thought, well, you know, that's a perfect example of what of ideas have consequences. What's the logical consequences of when you take God out of the equation of morality? What do you really get, you know? And of course, everybody thinks they have their answer, but the truth is without God, you really don't have any foundation for morality. You just ultimately have power. That's all there is power. The strong oppress the weak. And even oppression is not even a negative term. It doesn't mean anything. It's just strong win over the weak. That's all it is. And most people are unwilling or unable to accept that reality. They still want to maintain their notion of morality or however they try to do so, but you just can't do it. And when you do that on a societal level over time, you also get negative consequences. For example, when you teach students that they're just evolved animals, so there is morality is a social construct, they're just animals, you know, all religion is bad and evil, and they define their own reality internally. Well, it's no surprise then that they will start to behave that way and define their own reality and force it on others and end up in violent protests and riots against the people that they don't like. And that's what we see now, you know, all across the nation in higher education. And of course, it spills out into society at large as well. But I've always seen that higher education, the university, the colleges, that is where ideas often throughout history have begun and have mm-hmm. been cultivated amongst the intelligentsia, right? Amongst academia. And it's oftentimes in highfalutin language that normal people can't follow. But they study it, they develop it, then they teach it to their students. Their students grow up, go out and get jobs and go into the real world and bring that with them. And then that's what we're seeing now is those consequences. So I think that the university is very linked to the very destruction, self-destruction that's going on in this country right now. And that's the big picture of sort of where the idea comes from and what it's dealing with. And the philosophical foundation of what I'm doing. But don't get me wrong. It's like my goal is to write a new Silence of the Lambs. And I believe it's doing that because based on the responses of readers so far is that they find it immensely entertaining and actually informative, you know, where it gives them just enough. It's like I call it an intelligent thriller, you know, where it pushes your mind a little bit. But hey, this is still about capturing a serial killer and the excitement and thrills of, you know, of being stalked and trying to, you know, defeat evil, that kind of a thing. So, yeah, that's kind of the context.
We're definitely living in a massive crisis of our faith in these days.
Yeah.
Because you're absolutely right. I'll call it the liberal agenda. I'm not sure if that's fair terminology, but the liberal agenda for moral justice or social justice.
Yeah.
They borrow a lot of this verbiage and language from Catholicism, oddly enough. They borrow these words that are like designed to really pull people. And what happens is you get a lot of underinformed Christians who fall prey and victim to the ideas of their liberal social justice, which is really designed to pull this society's loss of our sense of God and our relationship to God as man.
Yeah.
And it inevitably leads to this practical materialism, breeding individualism, utilitarianism, and hedonism.
And that's really what you're saying and talking about with this.
Yeah, I would make one adjustment on that. I would say there's a sense which is actually, it's not so much, okay, there's an irony here because there is an ultimate individualistic subjectivity, right? You know, you define your own reality, but at the same time, the right. broader political ramifications and manifestations and goal is actually collectivist. It's more communism. It's you are nothing but a reflection of your identity is nothing but a reflection of a group. So if you belong to a group, you know, you're either good or bad based on the definition of that group being good or bad, which interestingly is exactly like Nazism, but the groups have been swapped, you know?
It doesn't take very long to fall.
Yeah, it evolves basically into that and the fascism that we also see, right? And so there is a very much of a collectivist, socialistic mindset, which is rooted in the Marxism that fuels a lot of the thinking, you know? And Jordan Peterson has talked a lot about this, how you know, Marxism mixed with post-modernity and higher education, and it's a mishmash in some ways of different beliefs. Yeah, so Jordan Peterson has touched on this stuff, and in fact, one of my characters in one of my protagonists in the novel Cruel Logic, his name is Joseph Callinger. He's the main psychiatrist who's helping the cop track down the killer. And he's kind of loosely based on Jordan Peterson, actually.
That's wonderful.
Because I love him, you know. And you know, if you watch him, you'll see him teaching, and you'll hear some similarities. Let's say, you know, and that character is actually, although he's not a Christian, he's actually a Jew who has lost his own faith in his background, right? And he's teaching Jungian psychology, and he wants to bring back Western civilization to the campus, but the students have been fighting him and the administration as well. So he's doing that, and that's the big picture thing, while he's also trying to track down this killer who is also making these moral arguments that go beyond a personal agenda, but they have something very specific he's trying to communicate.
It is actually a really interesting thriller story to hear about an individual wanting to bring in these philosophical ideas and agendas and determining whether somebody should live or die.
Yeah.
It brings me to wonder if a motivation like that could drive somebody that way would be based upon his own internal struggles being a man and not so much influenced. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's demons, but what psychology would lead a man to desire to end other people's lives?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're talking about the psychology of evil in a very real sense. And you know, Cruel Logic is kind of like I say, Silence of the Lambs or that movie Seven, you know, where it's rooted in research, you know, like I certainly did look into a lot of the issues related to insanity and how that's defined legally and the psychology of evil in that sense. But it's not seeking to try to be a hyper-realistic sort of scenario of the kinds of killers that are out there, you know? I mean, there are, you know, like there are cliches that the serial killers are all brilliant men, you know? And that's simply not true. Now, they're very cunning. They can be clever
and they can be intelligent.
Yeah, they can be very intelligent, but they're not necessarily brilliant, you know. They're often not. But certainly there are a lot of issues, you know, how you were raised, what traumas that happened in your past. And I touch on all of these, actually. I do bring these into the mix as part of the big package of everything. I deal with them, you know, but I think the purpose of this story is a little bit higher. And I would even argue that in a way my villain is a construct, you know, because despite all the theories about his background, which I do put in there, he's ultimately just a person who's become so dedicated to rationality, his belief in being rationally consistent, that he's simply taking his logic, his beliefs, his you know, atheistic worldview to its logical conclusion and acting that way. Yeah. He's pushing the envelope. And there's an experience that he has in his life that causes him to consider this. It's part of the story. But and so in a very real sense, you know, I suppose he's the kind of character that could exist. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of killers who really are, you know, driven by an evolutionary mindset. I mean, Dylan Klebold and, you know, the Columbine killers were following natural selection and Nietzsche. And there are killers throughout history who have rooted their behaviors, or shall we say, have rooted their justification for their behaviors. The human soul is very cunning when it is involved in the art of self-justification, right? So certainly they draw from evolution, natural selection, the strong over the weak, and there are many who are driven that way, and I believe that that's actually realistic. Yeah. Are there any that are philosophically proving something like this? You know, I think that's one element of the modern day storytelling, novels and movies, you know, where the serial killer is proving something, you know. I don't know how much of that is out in the real world for sure. But I also wrestle with the whole issue of insanity. And, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, in other words, the behavior that he's doing is so extreme that it is often considered insane, right? You know, guilty by reason of insanity. And of course, that's a cliche thing, but there's a recent, there's a more recent legal justification that's been used where it's insane but guilty, or not insane, but I forgot what the word is off the top of my head now. They don't use insane anymore. But basically criminally insane but guilty. You know, So in other words, if you're not guilty by reason of insanity, then when you go to the psych hospital, which is not as it's not as punishment oriented, it's not as security minded as the normal prisons, right? When you go to the psych hospital, when you're determined to be cured, you then go back out to society. Because it's because your insanity, right? If your insanity goes away, now obviously that often doesn't happen, but it sometimes does. And but if you're guilty but insane, then when you go to the psych hospital and you get declared healthy, you then go to the prison population. So that's one of the differences out there that they're trying to reckon with. And of course, the main concept is, you know, do you understand the difference between right and wrong when you're engaging in it? But see, that's a big concept to deal with, because there, you know, we know there are sociopaths and psychopaths who don't have that conscience, that sense of conscience of right and wrong. They don't care about right and wrong. And so, you know, is that insane or is that just simply evil? You know, and these are universal issues that these thriller stories all struggle with. And I struggle with all of them. But the one dimension I bring into that they haven't is this sort of understanding of, well, you know, there's a whole history of ethics in the history of mankind where we've sought to understand these things through philosophical means to try to find, well, what's the basis of morality? Is there morality? How do we know whether or not something's morally right or wrong? And that's the ultimate question, really. How do you know something's morally right or wrong? And the history of philosophy has sought to provide everything from utilitarian, it works, pragmatism, it works, right, to deontological, it's right because of some higher transcendent source, right? And on. And the problem is that without God, though, you can't justify any of them, you know? So I do wrestle in the story with this issue of evil, insanity, rationality. And there's a famous saying that I have in the novel by G.K. Chesterton, you know, and he says that many people think that madness is what they called it back then. You know, madness is when a man has lost his rationality. And he said, no, I think madness is when a man has lost everything but his rationality. And in a sense, that's what my character is, right? He has become ruthlessly rational, and he's pushing the beliefs to their logical conclusion, which is something that I would argue no atheist does, you know.
Yeah.
They think they're living consistently, but they really aren't, because according, you know, if at bottom reality is ultimately random and chance, then there is no such thing as morality. It's all arbitrary. It's just constructs. It's just facades for power. In that sense, postmodernism is right. Like if there is no God, then the postmodernism of the universities is technically correct. That is, everything is just a jockey for power, you know? And so that's the irony of it all that I try to also bring out is, well, yeah, if there is no God, then there is only power. But if there is a God, that's the only basis that you have to have moral authority behind any claims of morality whatsoever. And even though people think they have a justification, when you talk it through, you realize they really don't, you know?
Yeah, it really sounds like a walk down the darkness of the human mind and its ability to exist or try to exist in a world without God. It's basically a paradox, you know?
Yeah, it really is.
Human dignity is built upon the fact that we're made in the image and likeness of God. And that's all there is to that. And you take that away by some kind of agenda to, you know, make somebody less than man, you know, made in the image of God. What do you get? You get somebody who wants to fall into, you know, figures like Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot. And we saw what history did with those kind of individuals, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's fashionable now for, you know, people to seek to explain, oh, human flourishing is our goal. And, you know, who's a famous atheist guy?
I don't know one named by Sam.
Whatever. So, you know, there's this attempt to go, you know, we can all agree that, you know, whatever helps us to survive or whatever helps us to have human flourishing, this is a legitimate basis of morality. But it's like, well, human flourishing based on whose definition? I mean, Muslims think that you're flourishing if you killed all the Jews and enslave all the Christians, yeah. Right? So, I mean, whose definition? Sam Harris, that's it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's like the new atheist with a spirit
Sam Harris,
side.
You know, yeah, because the new atheism is dead. It pretty much failed in the public arena.
Yeah, so we need a new atheism.
Yeah, and okay. But you know, and I applaud him trying to support morality, but it's just nonsense. It's just, look, if there's no moral transcendent objective standard, then you can't say anything about morality. You can only say, this is what I like, this is what I want, or if we're in power, this is what we're going to do, you know? And, you know, it's ludicrous well, we all agree murder and rape is wrong. Well, no, we don't actually. none of the murderers believe it's wrong. And there are certainly entire, you know, cultures that believe genocide is acceptable. So you can't just say we all believe something or you know, we can all agree that genocide is wrong. Well, we can't. That's just it.
No, and culture's doing it today, yeah, and, even.
Yeah, exactly. And so and my argument would be, you know, this is where it gets to a much more nuanced level, is that what people don't realize is that we have been raised within this culture that's rooted in Judeo-Christianity. So whether or not you like it, you've been saturated in Judeo-Christian worldview thinking, and which includes morality, and you're stealing from Christianity the moral impulse and trying to craft your a morality that justifies it apart from the God that the morality comes from, right? So it's like, yeah, so basically, no, if the Judeo-Christian God is not real, then you can't say pedophilia is wrong. You can't, because pedophiles are saying exactly what the homosexuals said, if love is love, right?
Exactly.
And so there is, you know, without that objective transcendent standard to define what is right and wrong, or to adjudicate between competing worldviews, all you have is power. And now, the other thing that, atheists will try to appeal to is reason. Reason will tell us. Reason. And again, reason has nothing to do with morality. Reason has to do with maybe pointing out valid or invalid arguments, logical arguments, which is, of course, is what my character does. He's looking for a valid argument for morality, right?
Right.
You hear this all the time where it's just like reason. No, reason is just a tool for thinking logically valid, but it doesn't determine what is right and wrong. You still have to assume a standard. So you say, well, I use reason to say, well, we shouldn't enslave another person. Well, that's not reasonable. It's very reasonable within a different cultural construct, as all cultures throughout history have enslaved people. The only foundation that can tell you, that can justify slavery as wrong, is Judeo-Christianity, because man is created in the image of God, and we should not be, kidnapping and owning human beings like that, right? But if there is no objective standard to judge between the competing claims, then you can't just say, well, that's self-evident, that's obvious, slavery's wrong, because you you couldn't prove it, And I would argue that the whole impulse against slavery is also rooted in stealing from the Judeo-Christian worldview,
Yeah, it was Immanuel Kant who was the believer that morality was grounded in reason. Basically, it's like, we're not just sentient beings. We're not just sentient beings grounded on whether something feels good or something does not feel good.
Yeah.
It's like we're rational beings, right? We're capable of freedom. We must be capable of acting according to laws other than just the laws of physics, right? And we all know that just because it's legal doesn't mean it's moral.
Yeah.
Because in the times of people like Stalin, Hitler, Pol Pot, Mao, it was completely legal to turn over the people that they were trying to kill.
Yes. And of course now with the whole, there is a strong understanding of cultural differences. One positive element of the woke mentality is it does point out cultural differences. Of course, it's based on cultural relativism. In one sense, they claim that, cultures are relative, but then in another sense, they contradict themselves and they'll claim that their moral values about colonialism and homophobia, they'll claim that those are really morals that are, true, but they don't have any justification for their morals either. So, basically people try to relativize morality when it's against them, but then absolutize it when it's for them. That's the human impulse, which is what Nietzsche said, we rationalize our prejudices,
That's right.
And again, without the transcendent objective. Now, Kant actually also, there's a sense in which some of what Kant says is in the right direction with his transcendentalism, in that he was trying to discover, a transcendent objective standards, but you could ultimately have none without it being revealed, right? It's all just subjective social constructs, unless you have an objective standard revealed, which is the Bible, And I mean, Kant was positive religiously too. I mean, he's the one that said, the moral law within, I think it was, and the creation about, tells me about God and such. But in terms of philosophically, he did not put forward the Christian God as that foundation, and that's why it fails ultimately. His transcendental thinking is in the right direction, but it's an arbitrary transcendental that they create to justify their morality. And that's what Kant led to the modern world, where what we're struggling through now, right? Which is, the way things look are not the way things really are. The Ding Ein Sich, the way a thing really is. So appearance, he's tried to save the appearances. And this separation of, philosophical separation leads to, I may look like a male, but I feel like a female inside. And so that's why I define my reality based on my subjective whims, right? And that's the negation of external reality, I guess, in favor of the subjective, narcissistic, solipsistic worldview. You know, it's like everything surrounds around me, you know?
It's the idea of the Tower of Babel. It's no different. It's this giant effigy, this giant thing being built to reach the heavens to contain and confine God.
Yeah.
To make it what I want it to be. It's no different.
Yeah.
We're just not firing the bricks and making it a real thing. We're doing it psychologically.
Yeah. That's so true.
If we get back to your fiction here, how did you become interested in the psychology of crime and its related?
Most of my stories, including my movies and my novels, a universal theme that I wrestle with is human nature,
okay,
the nature of evil, and the existence of God. I think it's the universal struggle, even between all Christians, is, you know, why is there such suffering and such evil in this world created by God? It's a legitimate struggle in the human mind and heart, even of those who love and know God, to wonder and ask what. How is this way? Why is there so much evil in this world that created by God, you know?
Yeah.
And I can give you a theological, you know, explanation, but again, I think stories are the best way to embody that. And and so for example, like, you know, I think Dostoevsky's, you know, example in his story, Brothers Karamazov, where, you know, you have Ivan and Alyosha, you know, debating about God and morality and suffering. And it's probably I think Dostoevsky's on the level of any philosopher. You know what I mean? In fact, I had that whole element of the Brothers Karamazov in my novel, because I do believe the way Dostoevsky dealt with the problem of evil and the existence of God is on par, probably better than any other philosophical attempt, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And that was a story, that was a narrative, right? And so that's the power of narrative. And so I find myself drawn to that because I too struggle with that. I don't think you can be a human being with a soul and not be deeply just concerned for the suffering and the evil that is in the world. The more we see of it, and it's just devastating to the soul, you know? And if you have any shred of compassion, that should really bother you. And it does for me. And so I find a lot of my stories are me wrestling with that reality. Now, as a Christian, I like Job, wherever I am in that questioning process, I come to the conclusion of, I shut my mouth. I don't know anything. And God is the creator. And I bow before my creator and I trust in him. Right. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to still struggle with trying to understand it. Right. And so that's what I'm doing in this story. That's what I'm doing in all my stories, really. I've always loved to deal with this issue of the human nature, the problem of evil, and the existence of God. This is just the novel that is the most sort of explicit theologically about that, but really they're all about that. And and I think that the context is that the world that we live in is a world of great suffering and evil. It's also a lot of good. In fact, the context of that is, yet nevertheless, there is a kingdom of righteousness and justice that is growing in this world by the Spirit of God, bringing redemption to that world of suffering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the death of Jesus Christ is on the cross is the ultimate answer that, you know, people will not accept it unless they have the Spirit of God, which is our loving God does care about all the evil and suffering. In fact, he came and became a part of it. He took the suffering onto himself in order to redeem. And that's the story of my own life as a Christian, that I too lived in a world of depravity. You know, I was never like a big criminal or anything like that, but the narcissism, the pride, the whatever, selfish living of life, I know what that's like, and to be transformed and changed and to see my wretchedness before the holiness of my God and Creator, and that goodness within a world of pain, that goodness transforms you despite the pain. The pain doesn't go away. The world remains as it is, but you find the hope and the peace in that spiritual sense through Christ and through Him suffering with you, with us, so to speak, as a human, you know, as a human, in other words, but taking on our sin, all that, that's the gospel. And that's the only answer to the problem of evil in the end, yeah, you know,
in the end,
God, you know, in the end, it is God has a morally sufficient reason. He doesn't tell it to us, but He assures us He can be trusted by entering into that suffering with us and taking upon Himself our evil, so that we might be redeemed. That's the beauty of the gospel. That's the insanity of the gospel into the world's eyes, right? You know, it's the righteous man dying for the evil man, you know, taking his place. That's insane by godless perspectives. It doesn't make sense at all. But that's why I wrestle with these issues in all my story.
That's good. And that's that Dostoevsky, speaking about him, he did a really good job in Brothers talking about the existential angst that we feel. Everybody has this angst that they deal with some point in their life. You know, St. John of the Cross might call it the dark night of the soul. Whatever it is, we all have this existential angst, and we have to work through that. And did you find when you were doing any kind of research, any real life examples, real life example cases of some kind of, you know, socio-psychopathic murderer that would be some kind of, I don't know, inspiration?
No, not particularly. I mean, I did read a lot of them, you know, and textbooks about the psychology and such of some of the more famous ones, etc., just to understand the mindset a little bit, and the reality of it and the varying possibilities. And but no one in particular. But I do remember, though, that it is a world that I don't like. Swimming in that world, you know, you got to research and you got to get into it to understand it. But I've found that I don't know about some people who write all these thriller novels all the time, but I can't stay in it very long. I mean, I'm glad to be out of it. You know, it's just so dark. It really is. Yeah. So that's a tough one, you know, which is.
Yeah. It looks like you spent, you know, a better time doing something along the lines of Hannibal Lecter with Silence of the Lambs and the psychological dynamics that are going on between. Well, I mean, if we were to say specifically Silence of the Lambs, we're going to say that Hannibal and Clarice have this psychological phenomenon that's going on between each other, right?
Yeah.
But it's more than that. There's a psychological tension that's below the surface level. And we don't really, you have to really read between the lines or watch the movies to really see what's going on in this dark mindset, because it's more, you know, it's more than just like being inspired by a supernatural force to commit, you know, the human mind is capable of vast levels of evil. And when we acknowledge the fact that humans can do evil things, but choose not to, is the value that we should take away from stories like this.
That's an excellent point. In fact, I firmly believe that life, behavior is a series of incremental choices. And so even the most, and this is why, you know, you look back in the people's past and killer's past, and, you know, they first start out killing insects and torturing animals, and it grows, and you feed the bad dog, literally, you know, versus the good dog, so to speak. And I do believe in that reality that people make incremental choices throughout their life. And that's why we are more capable of greater evil than we realize, than we think. Yeah. We all think we're all heroes and we would never do this, you know. But I think it is. Now, there are some factors to be involved that are involved. I think that some physical maladies to some degree, there's a lot of factors involved. And there is this one case. It was kind of a famous case, and I think it was in the 70s. It was this researcher was doing brain scans of criminals, you know, and he had a control group too, you know, because it having to do with, you know, I don't know, like the hypothalamus being smaller and such. There are these cases are like the limbic region. There are a lot of times that are smaller in killers, you know. And this is the whole nature nurture debate, you know, which I also have in the novel. And I don't try to sort of make a definitive case because I don't think there is a definitive case. We are psychosocial, spiritual, physical beings, and all of that's wrapped up, right? And so everything can be effective. But nevertheless, this guy, this researcher, had done this research, these scans and stuff, and he had so he divvied out the scans based on these parameters of the electrochemical sort of realities of the brain to find that the criminals, the sociopaths that they knew versus the control group, right? And they definitely had that smaller capacity in their limbic region, right? But he found out that one of the brain scans was his own in the criminal batch. It had accidentally somehow got a part of the research, and it just floored him. And of course, you know, he's not a killer, but he realized that, oh, so he had the same sort of sociopathic tendencies that the other killers do, but the difference was the choices he made in his life, you know. And it was just a fascinating reality that reinforces no matter whether it's your environment, whether you're abused, whether you've got, you know, smaller limbic region, all these factors, you still have to make choices to do the evil that you do, and if you can choose against it. So I, you know, one of my favorite movies that expresses this notion is A Beautiful Mind, you know, with Russell Crowe. And of course that was just about him having this schizophrenic, you know, person or voice. You know, it wasn't a real person. In reality, it was a voice, but in the movie, it was this person who would speak to him and delude him, right? But by the end of the movie, he doesn't get rid of it. He learns to cope with it by not listening to the voice, and he's further in the background, you know. And the more he listens to the voice, the closer he becomes, right? And so by the end of the movie, he overcomes it by not listening to that voice, and it's as simple as that. Now, if you're speaking about what does this have to do with God? Well, you know, you're not going to save yourself or, you know, become a good person on your own power to be able to merit God's acceptance of you. But nevertheless, in terms of the nature of the human nature and the power God has given us to choose good and evil, you can clearly, let's put it this way, clearly sociopaths still make choices. And there are people who are more in that tendency but have been able to choose not to and to refocus it. Of course, you know, one of my favorites was Decker.
Okay.
Dexter. Yeah. Where, you know, he was the guy who was like, he was a serial killer guy who had that nature, but he had a moral sense about him. So he ended up using it to kill other serial killers, you know, which of course, yeah. You know, you could argue is a little twisted, but again, that shows that we still have the capacity to choose. And, so that's I agree with you about that. These are the choices we make in our lives, and it's the little choices. It begins with the little ones that build to the big ones.
I had spoken with a couple of other people about this one guy. His name was John Lawson. He was the Pazuzu killer back in 2010 in North Carolina.
Pazuzu killer?
Right. So if you haven't heard of John Lawson, it's kind of an interesting story to look at. It's definitely not parallel with the kind of individual that you're trying to portray as a serial killer. He heard and had to do ritual murders and sacrifices, etc.
Sure.
And ended up dead in his own prison cell through either a self-inflicted wound or wounds that couldn't be explained, mm-hmm. Okay. etc. And it was kind of a real interesting story. And there's he had this fascination with, you know, Aleister Crowley and the Aramaic language, Sumerian language, etc.
Wow.
It was quite an interesting story of a sociopath who might have been inspired by something outside of the human mind, basically.
Sure, sure.
Not to deny an individual's choice, because ultimately we have the right to choose. And, you know, someone like that who never sought help.
Well, I think the spiritual world is one of the multiple factors that can influence us. Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting because in the Crew Logic, I it's a different tack than I've taken with all my Bible novels, which do deal a lot with the demonic world and such. And this one, I wanted to sort of focus on the human responsibility element of it. But I certainly do agree that demons can become somewhat a part of some of these killers, you know, realities, you know. Absolutely.
All right. So as we're wrapping up, what are either things that you've got? I mean, you got a sequel coming for Cruel Logic?
Yeah, I do. Well, it's a standalone novel, so the series is okay. Going to be different. Standalone novels. And I do have a great idea for the next one, but first I have to do my next Chronicles of the Watchers book. So I'm working on prep for that first, and then I'll get back to the other series, you know. And I can't talk about it yet because it's so wild. It's so wild, but it's going to be so cool. But anyway, so I'm working on my next Watchers novel.
I really hope you do one on Ezekiel.
I can't say which one this one is.
I know you can't say, and I wasn't trying to get you to say. I just hope you do one on Ezekiel someday.
I'll keep that in mind.
Because that would be an awesome one to talk about.
Oh, man, there's so many that, you know, that you could do from the Bible.
How could people find you, etc.?
Sure. Well, Crew Logic, all my books are exclusively on Amazon, but they're in paperback, Kindle, audiobook, hardcover. So everything's there. So you can find my books there, Crew Logic. But if you want to look more into me, I do have a website that's informative about all my stuff, and just Gadawa.com, my name, Gadawa.com. Thanks for having me on. It's been a great discussion, and I appreciate the depth that you're willing to go. It's been great.
Thank you for listening. This is a free podcast based upon the value for value model. If you find value in this or any episode, you can return that value by liking the show, subscribing to this channel, leaving a review, or sharing with a friend on your social media accounts. You can also donate on my website. Thank you again. This is BT for Truth and Shadow Podcast. You are the light in the darkness.